to comment.
Yeah, if we go first to what Senator Sanders was saying, I think it's absolutely critical to remind ourselves this measure will not make America any safer. What Rudy Giuliani was saying, that these are countries that are targeted because they have terrorists that have been sent to the United States, is absolutely false. There are zero deaths caused in terrorist attacks by citizens of these countries on U.S. soil. Zero. Now, there are several other countries that have citizens who've been involved in terrorist acts in U.S. soil that have killed people, but none of those countries are on this list that the Trump administration has been using. And what Sanders said
Five
is also
seconds.
Quite— This is feeding into a narrative of a clash of civilizations, which is exactly the narrative of ISIS. So it's not surprising that those people, those jihadists, actually have been welcoming what Trump is doing.
Tarita Parsi, we want to thank you for being with us, of the National Iranian American Council, and Linda Sarsour. Thank you for joining us as well. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Dina Gezder, as well as the whole team here. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Hey, it's Shenna from Pacific Underground, the radio show where Asians and Pacific Islanders take the mic into our own hands. Join us this Friday at 9 a.m. for a special live episode where the entire Pacific Underground crew will join me for a lively roundtable discussion about new political policies affecting Asians and Pacific Islanders. We'll also have live interviews, and we'll be taking your calls to talk about what's important to you and your API community. So tune in for a special Pacific Underground this Friday, February 3rd at 9 a.m., right here on KBOO, your community radio station.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The time is now 5:01 p.m. Up next is your Tuesday evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new Supreme Court nominee is expected to be announced any minute.
And ICE continues to arrest people at the Multnomah County Courthouse and in Gresham.
And the Sierra Club of Oregon creates rapid response teams. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 31st, 2017. I'm Candace Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenna Yokoyama. Donald Trump is poised to announce his nominee for the open seat on the Supreme Court this evening. We'll be breaking from our newscast for that announcement. The ninth seat on the Supreme Court has been vacant since the death of Justice Antonin Scalia last February. Last March, President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to fill the spot, but has yet to be confirmed. Congress has managed to set the record for the longest amount of time a nominee has gone without either being confirmed or rejected by the Senate. The previous record was set in 1916 for the nomination of Woodrow Wilson's pick, Louis Brandeis, having to wait 125 days before being confirmed. It is highly unusual for the Supreme Court to have a vacant seat for nearly a year that have been identified as being considered in Trump's search for a future Supreme Court justice.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. When Justice Scalia passed away suddenly last February, I made a promise to the American people. If I were elected president, I would find the very best judge in the country for the Supreme Court. I promise to select someone who respects our laws and is representative of our Constitution, and who loves our Constitution, and someone who will interpret them as written. This may be the most transparent judicial selection process in history. Months ago, as a candidate, I publicly presented a list of brilliant and accomplished people to the American electorate and pledged to make my choice from among that list. Millions of voters said this was the single most important issue to them when they voted for me for president. I am a man of my word. I will do as I say, something that the American people have been asking for from Washington for a very, very long time. Thank you. Today, I am keeping another promise to the American people by nominating Judge Neil Gorsuch of the United States Supreme Court to be of the United States Supreme Court. And I would like to ask Judge Gorsuch and his wonderful wife, Louise, to please step forward. Please, Louise, Judge. Here they come. Here they come. So was that a surprise? Was it? I have always felt that after the defense of our nation, the most important decision a president of the United States can make is the appointment of a Supreme Court justice. Depending on their age, a justice can be active for 50 years, and his or her decisions can last a century or more and can often be permanent. I took the task of this nomination very seriously. I have selected an individual whose qualities define really, and I mean closely define, what we're looking for. Judge Gorsuch has outstanding legal skills, a brilliant mind, tremendous discipline, and has earned bipartisan support. When he was nominated to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, he was confirmed by the Senate unanimously. Also, that's unanimous. Can you believe that nowadays with what's going on? Does that happen anymore? Does it happen? I think it's going to happen, maybe again. Also with us tonight is Maureen Scalia, a woman loved by her husband and deeply respected by all. I am so happy she is with us. Where is Maureen? Please stand up. Thank you, Maureen.
That was breaking news from Donald Trump announcing his nominee for the Supreme Court Justice. As you just heard, it is Neil M. Gorsuch of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. He also said one of the most important decisions a U.S. president can make is nominating a Supreme Court Justice. Several Democrats in the Senate have already vowed to block any candidate that Trump nominates, including Oregon's Senator Jeff Merkley, who has said he will filibuster the nominee. Stay tuned to KBOO News for updates on this matter.
During his first week in office, Donald Trump has signed a number of executive orders that have both citizens and media outlets scrambling to understand what our country will look like in the coming years. These orders range in scope. Early this week, Trump instituted a global gag ruling on abortion and an order to expedite the environmental evaluation of the Keystone and Dakota pipelines. On Friday, he passed a contentious order that blocked refugees and legal immigrants from several Muslim-majority countries from entering the country. While Trump's executive orders are shaking the country, the volume of executive orders that he has signed in the first week on the job is not entirely unusual. It's common for a new president to put out many executive actions and orders at the start of their term. It's seen as a way to set a tone for the administration as well as to start fulfilling campaign processes while sidestepping the more slowly moving legislative branch. In his first week, Trump has signed 6 executive orders and 8 presidential memoranda. During the same period of time in his presidency, Barack Obama signed 5 executive orders. Historically, executive orders have had an immense impact on the course of American politics and life. The Emancipation Proclamation, for example, was an executive order, as was the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Already, some have fought against these orders by arguing that they are unconstitutional. The Supreme Court is the body that will ultimately decide whether or not many of these orders can stand. These cases may be decided by the person who Trump himself has just appointed, Judge, what was it?
Garland.
No, Gorsuch.
Gorsuch.
Look at that. It's that breaking. We can't even get it in our minds yet.
It's that important. Washington State is suing Trump. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson announced yesterday that he is filing a lawsuit against Donald Trump and the Homeland Security Department. The lawsuit concerns last Friday's executive order banning travelers from 7 countries from entering the United States. The suit seeks to have several provisions of the order to be declared unconstitutional, claiming it violates the 5th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, as well as asking for temporary restraining order against enforcement of the executive order. Trump's executive order, which also suspended the entire refugee program, sparked protests at airports nationwide, including Seattle-Tacoma Airport, where 3,000 people are reported to have attended. Mr. Ferguson is one of 16 state attorneys general who issued a statement on Sunday calling Trump's action un-American and unlawful. Washington Governor Jay Inslee was also present at the announcement and stated, quote, "Its impact, its cruelty, its clear purpose is an unconscionable religious test, and its effect in America is that it's unconstitutional," end quote. When asked about the possibility of reprisal from the Trump administration, both Inslee and Ferguson said they would not be intimidated or bullied into backing down.
Refugee resettlement advocates say the executive order signed Friday by President Trump to halt resettlement of any refugees in the United States for 120 days leaves tens of thousands of refugees already in the process with few options. KBOO's Khalid Mosley, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, has more.
Groups that work to resettle refugees in the United States says the executive order signed by President Trump leave thousands of refugees in limbo. The order signed late Friday afternoon halts the resettlement of all refugees in the United States for 120 days and no from Syria until further notice. And it cuts the number that will be resettled this year by more than half. According to Jennifer Sahn with the International Rescue Committee, that leaves some 60,000 refugees already in the pipeline wondering if they'll be able to come here or not.
Many of those people have been already approved and are literally just waiting to get on a plane. And they're living in difficult circumstances, either in urban settings where they have very few resources or in refugee camps.
Refugees, immigrants, and even green card holders from 7 predominantly Muslim countries who were in transit when the order was signed were detained on arrival and in some cases sent back. The executive order calls for extreme vetting of all applicants for the refugee status. But Sahn points out that the U.S. vetting process already is most stringent in the world, taking 18 to 24 months and involving 3 government agencies, including Homeland Security.
There's many places in the process to catch any discrepancies in the stories or the background of the refugees. So it's already a very, very tight system.
Under the executive order, Syrian refugees will be denied entry to the United States until further notice, regardless of any vetting process. Last year, the U.S. settled just 10,000 Syrians, far fewer than most other Western countries. Sahn believes that the United States has a moral responsibility to do more.
It is part of our tradition, and this country was founded by refugees and immigrants who came fleeing from all parts of the world, and we're not really living up to our values in our history.
While the executive order was promoted as a way to prevent terrorists from entering the country, a study by the Cato Institute found the likelihood of an American being killed by terrorists entering the country as a refugee to be 1 in 3.64 billion per year. This is the Oregon News Service. I am Khalid Mosley. Have a good day.
Since the election in November, there have been reports of an increase in immigration arrests at Multnomah County courthouses. These reports started with public defenders who say immigration agents have been asking people inside courthouses to identify themselves. The inquiries appear to focus primarily on people of color. This week, OPB and the Oregonian both spoke with federal immigration officials who confirmed several arrests near county courthouses in the last month. Spokesperson Virginia Kice told the Oregonian that ICE practices have not changed from those under the Obama administration, saying that the rate of arrests has remained consistent. Attorneys, Multnomah County judges, and immigrant advocates remain concerned about the potential impact of an ICE crackdown. Judge Nan Waller says that the fear of immigration arrests can keep people from coming to the courthouse in eviction cases and when they need to file restraining orders. Judge Edward Jones says immigration status is also irrelevant to wage theft cases because all workers have a right to sue employers for unpaid wages. Concerns are higher now because of the uncertainty around how Customs and Border Patrol are handling Friday's executive order on immigration and whether people who are detained or deported will have the opportunity to return legally. Defense lawyers pledge to continue to protect their clients from ICE scrutiny, advising them to not answer questions about their immigration status.
In case you thought the severe winter weather was over, brace yourselves. Later this week, we're expected to see more snow and freezing rain. Cape reporter Al Khan spoke to Jerry Mack from the Portland office of the National Weather Service.
Okay, what we're having is there'll be some wintry weather later in the week here, starting in the Portland area. Thursday, late afternoon to early evening, we expect precipitation to start as snow. We'll probably get 1 or upwards of 2 inches of snow in the Portland metro area Thursday evening, and then it'll start switching over to freezing rain, and that'll happen about midnight or so, and it'll probably continue as freezing rain for all the way through Friday evening before it warms up enough to turn over to just plain old rain.
Okay, and do you have any idea what ODOT is doing for this?
No, I really don't. They haven't talked to us. Now, there's regular conference calls that we do, and we're holding one here in about 10 minutes with all the different many media and governmental agencies, and then they'll be hearing what our forecast is, and then they'll take the appropriate actions as they need to.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, you're welcome.
For KBU News, this is Al Khan.
Last week, the Washington Department of Ecology published its first quarterly report on oil transport in the state, including important new information on oil trains. This new report gives the public information on how much oil is moving by rail and where. In the last quarter of 2016, trains delivered nearly 15 million barrels of crude oil, more than 20,000 rail cars to Washington's 5 refineries, all located on the Puget Sound. The BNSF Railway handled roughly 96% of the oil cargo. Union Pacific carried only about 4%. Nearly all the oil originated in North Dakota, passed through Spokane, and ran along the Columbia River Gorge before turning north to destinations on the Puget Sound. Most oil trains pass through the state's biggest population centers en route to refineries.
U.S. Representative Jason Chaffetz of Utah has introduced a bill that would direct the Interior Secretary to immediately sell off an area of public land the size of Connecticut. Chaffetz claims that the 3.3 million acres maintained by the Bureau of Land Management serves, quote, no purpose for taxpayers. Many in the 10 states that would lose federal land in the bill disagree, and public land rallies in opposition are bringing together environmentalists and sportsmen across the West. KBOO's reporters spoke with Erica Stock of Oregon Sierra Club about how the club is forming a response team to address the challenging environmental issues that are all suddenly in play.
Erica, we understand that there's a rapid response team being formulated by your organization. Can you tell me what it is?
The Rapid Response Team is a powerful network of grassroots volunteers that's being organized by Sierra Club here in Oregon. And there's also opportunities across the country in other states. And these are for people who want to take immediate and regular action to defend our progress and values in response to the Trump administration and all the anti-environment, anti-justice agendas that we're likely to see.
I would assume it's a response to specific issues as they arise. Is that correct?
That's correct, but they tend to cluster into themes. So while we'll be having calls to action on specific items, we anticipate to see, you know, a lot of threats to the environment, a lot of threats to members of our community, and so we'll be calling on people to get in touch with the folks that represent them to make sure that we're making our voices heard in Washington, D.C. from all Oregonians.
So will the membership of the team vary depending on the issue or the timing, or how will that work?
No, so this is really an opportunity for everyone among the general public as well as Sierra Club members to kind of, you know, sign up to receive these alerts. And when they receive these alerts, they'll be able to get on the phone and have certain talking points, and they'll know about certain threats as soon as they're available so that they can reach out to their elected representatives.
When will the team go into action?
We are getting the infrastructure up and ready right now. What people can do immediately is to go on our website, and towards the bottom of the page, they'll see a post about this rapid response team, and they can provide their email address, and we will put them right on that list and start reaching out to them.
We have a specific issue that came up today, and I wonder if we could talk mm-hmm. about how the team might work in relation to that particular issue. That's a bill that was introduced in the House in Washington by Representative Chaffetz of Utah to sell 3.3 million acres of federal land that's managed by the Bureau of Land Management.
That particular issue is just so jarring, specifically because public lands provide billions of dollars to our economy, as well as providing, you know, clean water and clean air that we don't necessarily have a monetary value for. And about 98% of all Americans in the West actually oppose efforts to sell off private or to privatize public lands. And so what we're hoping to do is tap in to that energy around really standing up for our public lands and the lands that we own as Americans, and to put pressure on our elected representatives to make sure when they're voting on this in Washington, D.C., that they're voting to represent Oregon's values. Now, most of our congressional representatives have a good voting record on that. The exception to that is Representative Walden, so it's going to be really important through our rapid response team to mobilize people in his district so that they're giving him phone calls, showing up in his office and writing letters, and doing work with the local newspapers to make sure that he gets the message loud and clear that Oregonians really value our public lands. We want to keep them in public hands.
So if someone like myself saw this situation, I guess we would call in to the Sierra Club and try and get involved with this rapid response process on this issue. Would that be right?
That's correct. And we also have calls to action that will be linked up on our website. So if you go to our website, sierraclub.org/Oregon, you'll see opportunities to engage there as well.
Our guest has been Erica Stock of Oregon's Sierra Club. Erica, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Trans Positive at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be mostly cloudy, with wind in Portland area with a high of 40 and a low of 32. There's a 10% chance of precipitation. In Hood River, skies will be cloudy, with afternoon highs predicted to be 34 degrees, dipping as low as 26 overnight with a chance of snow flurries. Today in history, in 1865, the House of Representatives passed the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which abolished slavery. Our quote of the day comes from Frederick Douglass, who in response to the amendment being passed said, quote, "I hold that the work of the abolitionists is not done. Slavery has been called by a great many names, and it will call itself by yet another name. And you and I, all of us, have had better wait and see what new form this old monster will assume, and what new skin this old snake will come forth."
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Uncle Sam wants you. Not the Uncle Sam, who's the symbolic caricature of our country, but Sam Johnson. Although he's been a member of Congress for a quarter of a century, it's unlikely you've ever heard of him. For Sam's been what's known in legislative circles as furniture. That's a lawmaker who holds a congressional seat, but just sits in it, achieving so little that he's unnoticeable. But look out, Johnson has suddenly leapt into action. and we all need to take notice because this Texas Republican has unveiled what he calls his, quote, plan to permanently save Social Security. To get you to support the plan, Uncle Sam wants you to believe that our nation's very popular retirement program is, quote, going bankrupt. He knows that's a lie, but he hopes it's a big enough lie to panic you into doing anything to save the program. To make his plan easy to swallow, he coats it with another lie, claiming that he's merely modernizing and updating Social Security, which a big majority of Americans count on to avoid stark poverty in their golden years. But in fact, old Uncle Sam is conniving to save Social Security by gutting it. The press release announcing his Reform Act doesn't even mention the key fact that it's based on making workers keep paying the same 12.4% tax on their wages, but getting drastically less paid back to them when they retire. How much less? Up to 69% less, cutting a total of $11.6 trillion in benefits promised to America's workers. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, Representative Johnson has announced his own retirement after 28 years sitting in Congress. And yes, he can draw a Social Security check, but he also gets a congressional pension that'll pay him more than $70,000 a year. How about we cut that perk and leave people's Social Security alone?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
An executive order signed on Saturday rearranged the seats on the principal committee of the National Security Council. This change gives a spot to Steve Bannon, whose position as chief advisor and strategist is currently to the White House. The order also demoted the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of National Intelligence from the principal's committee. They will be included only when their expertise is directly needed. The seats on the council are normally held only by military and intelligence officials. James Steinberg, the former deputy national security advisor in the Clinton administration, called the change a rejection of the shared principle that politics has no place in matters of national security. Bannon was previously executive chair of Breitbart News, an extreme right-wing news site favored by the neo-Nazi alt-right. Including Bannon on the National Security Council in this way elevates concerns about his role in the administration and influence over national security issues. Bernie Sanders called for Bannon to be removed, saying that the choice is dangerous and unprecedented. While Bannon's current position in the White House did not require a Senate hearing, Newsweek journalist Jonathan Alter has suggested that an appointment to the National Security Council may require one.
On Capitol Hill, half a dozen committee votes on cabinet nominations were scheduled Tuesday, but not all made it that far. The Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee advanced Betsy DeVos, the nominee for Education Secretary, despite her total lack of experience with public education and her personal ties with student loan companies and deep financial support for the GOP. The Energy Natural Resources Committee also advanced two nominees, former oil man and Texas Governor Rick Perry for Energy Secretary and Montana Representative Ryan Zinke as Interior Secretary. But other hearings were more contentious. Senate Democrats boycotted the Finance Committee, stalling the meeting where votes were set for Treasurer nominee Steven Mnuchin and Health and Human Services nominee Tom Price. And the Senate Judiciary Committee, clearly split along party lines, took their time making remarks ahead of a vote on President Trump's pick for Attorney General. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
It is very difficult to reconcile for me the independence and objectivity necessary for the position of Attorney General with the partisanship this nominee has demonstrated.
California Senator Dianne Feinstein began the Democrats' detailed descriptions of why they would not support Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions for the post of U.S. Attorney General, citing his record on reproductive rights, voting rights, torture, and civil rights. Lawmakers listed the arenas in which they doubt Sessions would defend the legal rights of U.S. citizens. Denied a seat on the federal bench in the 80s after allegations of racism, Sessions says his record proves those claims false. But Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy said that Sessions has demonstrated an unwillingness to protect the nation's most marginalized communities.
Time and again, when the rights of women of LGBTQ individuals, disenfranchised communities, have been debated here in the Senate. Senator Sessions has not sought to protect their civil and human rights. Too often he has been the one, sometimes the only one, standing in the way. In 2009, Senator Sessions opposed extending hate crime protections to women and LGBT individuals, groups that have been historically targeted based merely on who they are. And he stated, quote, "I am not sure women or people with different sexual orientations face that kind of discrimination. I just don't see it." Well, open your eyes and you will see it.
12 days into the Trump presidency, the rash of executive orders and presidential memoranda already issued were front and center for lawmakers like Feinstein, uncertain about Sessions' ability to separate political allegiance from the legal underpinnings of the orders.
The president's nominee, a colleague of ours for some 20 years, is well known for his positions and point of view. He's been a staunch campaign partisan for the president. He has reinforced and supported the Trump mission, style, rhetoric, and views. He was the first senator to endorse. He has attended at least 45 Trump campaign events. He wore the hat. He was a leading voice.
The hastily implemented ban on immigrants and travelers from 7 Muslim-majority nations was repeatedly cited. The California senator said the attorney general must administer justice fairly and impartially for all Americans.
We're being asked to vote on a nominee that will have to stand up to a president who is clearly willing to ignore the law and even issue orders in violation of the Constitution.
Monday, acting U.S. Attorney General Sally Yates did just that, instructing Department of Justice staff not to legally enforce the travel ban. Within hours, President Trump fired her. Again, Vermont Senator Leahy.
And what we saw last night illustrates what's at stake with this nomination. I've said and I believe that the president's decision to fire Acting Attorney General Sally Yates is shameful. His accusation that she betrayed the Department of Justice is dangerous. The Attorney General is the people's attorney, not the president's attorney.
Yates was confirmed as Deputy Attorney General in 2015. During her confirmation hearings, as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Sessions had similar concerns about Yates' willingness to stand up to a presidential order.
You have to watch out because people will be asking you to do things you just need to say no about. Do you think the Attorney General has a responsibility to say no to the president if he asks for something that's improper? A lot of people have defended the Lynch nomination, for example, by saying, well, he appoints somebody who's going to execute his views. What's wrong with that? But if the views the president wants to execute are unlawful, should the Attorney General or the Deputy Attorney General say no?
Senator, I believe that the Attorney General or the Deputy Attorney General has an obligation to follow the law and the Constitution and to give their independent legal advice to the president.
In a departure from rules enforced in other committees during confirmation proceedings, Judiciary Committee Chair Chuck Grassley allowed unfettered remarks ahead of the vote. Senators cycled through the committee as they came and went to cast votes in other congressional venues, often dropping the committee below quorum and stalling the proceedings. The final committee vote was delayed until Wednesday, when lawmakers are expected to advance Senator Sessions along party lines, sending his nomination to the full chamber for a final vote. Nell Abram, FSRN.
The confirmation hearings for Jeff Sessions as Attorney General continue today, as we just heard. Acting Attorney General Sally Yates was asked by the new administration to stay on until Sessions is confirmed by the Senate. On Monday night, President Donald Trump fired Yates after she told Justice Department employees not to defend Friday's executive order banning entry for people from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Yates' letter to Justice Department lawyers expressed concern that the executive order was not lawful or compatible with the sworn responsibilities of the department. These concerns are matched by a dissent memo signed by dozens of State Department officials, which said the policy would close U.S. borders to millions of legitimate travelers and will not achieve the aim of making the country safer. The White House's statement on the firing criticized Yates as an Obama administration appointee who was not loyal to the Trump administration. The statement said that Yates is, quote, weak on borders and very weak on illegal immigration. Yates was appointed as Deputy Attorney General under Obama in 2015, but her career in the department spans both the Bush and Obama administrations. Yates was immediately replaced by Dana Bente, the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. Bente reversed Yates' order upholding Trump's executive action as constitutional.
Monday morning, District Court Judge James Boasberg convened a status hearing with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, Dakota Access, and attorneys for the Army Corps of Engineers. The purpose of the hearing was to determine when the Army Corps would have a decision to Mr. Trump's presidential memo on the pipeline. The government responded that they have made no decision at this time and have no timeline in place as to when they might have a decision. A second hearing has been scheduled for next Monday. Judge Boasberg has said he wants the answers to two questions. When will the Army have a decision on how to proceed? And if the easement is granted, how long will it take DAPL to complete the project? The Army Corps of Engineers has already once denied the easement and has launched an environmental impact study to study the possibility of finding a new route for the project, which is an option that Energy Transfer Partners refuses to accept. A military veterans group, Veterans Stand, has announced new plans to support the Standing Rock Tribe and the water protectors opposing the completion of the project. The group is developing plans where thousands of veteran volunteers can deploy to Standing Rock to support the water protectors. Veteran Stand has also launched a GoFundMe account last week seeking to raise $500,000 to buy supplies for the camp and provide rides for volunteers. $19,000 has been raised in just 2 days. The presence of Veteran Stand and other veteran groups at the Standing Rock camp pose uncomfortable situation for Donald Trump after the backlash he suffered from mocking the Pakistani-American parents of a fallen soldier.
A law passed today in the United Kingdom that pardons thousands of men convicted of offenses that once criminalized homosexuality but are no longer on the statute books. Britain's Justice Minister called it a momentous day, as this so-called Turing's Law got royal assent, although critics said the move does not go far enough to redress historic wrongs. The legislation follows a posthumous pardon for Enigma codebreaker Alan Turing, who was convicted of gross indecency and subsequently killed himself in 1954 at the age of 41. Under what is known as the disregard process, anyone previously found guilty of past sexual offenses that are no longer criminal matters can ask to have them removed from their record. An estimated 50,000 to 100,000 men were convicted under discriminatory anti-gay laws between 1885 and 2003, the latter being the year when all homophobic sexual offensive legislation was finally repealed in England and Wales. The last men who were executed for homosexuality in England were James Pratt and John Smith, who were hanged in 1835.
Last November, voters in Denver narrowly decided to allow public use of marijuana in private establishments with permits. Permit applications just became available, and FSRN's Hannah Leigh Myers visited an information cafe in downtown Denver that's ready to apply.
In 2000, Colorado became one of the first states to legalize medical marijuana.
I've lived in total pain for 6 or 7 years, and I know that marijuana does help. It curbs my pain. So I'm in Colorado.
Then in 2012, recreational pot was legalized.
And now Colorado becomes the first state in the country to legalize marijuana possession. It is a historic night, any way you look at it.
And now, business owners in Denver, like Jim Norris of Mutiny Information Cafe, are starting to apply for permits that, for the first time in history, will allow marijuana consumption in public places.
I want to do a once-a-month night here, Saturday night. We'll have comedy, dance party, DJs, that kind of stuff. So it'll be laid back and cool. 21 and over, I'll have security. I'll follow whatever the rules are the city wants us to do.
Initiative 300, passed by Denver voters in 2016, could make Norris's plans a reality by late this year, when the city begins issuing permits. In the meantime, a diverse committee will craft strict permit rules. One of the toughest requirements already written into the initiative makes it necessary for permit holders to get approval from surrounding neighborhood groups. Mason Tavert, director of communications for the Marijuana Policy Project, explains some of the other pre-established I-300 stipulations.
Under Initiative 300, adults would be able to vaporize or use other non-smokable forms of marijuana inside, and they would be able to smoke marijuana in places where smoking is already currently allowed, but only if it's not viewable to the public.
Tavert played a significant role in the passage of Amendment 64 that legalized recreational marijuana in Colorado. He also backed I-300, saying the initiative will bring Colorado one step closer to realizing Amendment 64's ultimate goal.
When voters approved Amendment 64 in 2012, they said we want marijuana to be treated similarly to alcohol. And that has not happened yet when it comes to places where adults can consume.
Although I-300 will give the public a place to consume cannabis similar to a bar, patrons will need to bring their own marijuana, and it will be illegal to consume alcohol and pot at the same establishment. Back at Mutiny, co-owner Jim Norris says he's glad the rules are strict and that the city plans to take its time formulating even more rigorous standards for the public marijuana consumption permits.
I think it should be really involved. This is like, you know, we're starting something really big here. Really, really big. You know, this is democracy in action. We voted for it. The city and the state has to come up with a way to make it happen.
Norris is confident Mutiny Information Cafe will rapidly meet permit requirements. What is less certain is if the federal government will continue to take a hands-off approach in cities and states where marijuana rules passed through ballot initiatives clash with federal drug laws. Hannah Lee Myers, FSRN, Denver.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Audrey Eskright, Tom Flynn, Al Khan, Laura Klinkner, and Khalid Mosley. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Charity Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jenna Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7 is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Rowland takes your calls on Wednesday Talk Radio. And then at 9, Project Censored Radio tackles fake news plus the connection between environmental activism and racial justice. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. And at 11, The Bike Show looks at the cultural impact of bicycles in film, literature, and comics. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Kanan.
Good night, Jenna.
All right, Wesley.
Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Two Tuesdays ago, you listened to a conversation between News Director Charity Marchant, myself, Jenny Okuyama, and Kanan Schlesinger. We discussed the Women's March that had happened just a few days before. And here we are 2 weeks later, and we had another rally this weekend, the AMA March for Justice and Equality. At these two different marches, we saw quite a marked difference. And so we're here to discuss that today here on News in Depth.
Sure are.
Thanks for joining me, Charity.
Thanks for joining me. Thanks for joining us, all of us.
You're welcome.
So to kind of recap, back at the Women's March, we had discussed that I had actually attended the march, but Charity had not. And Kanan, you had attended the march briefly, yes?
I didn't attend the march. I attended the rally, the post.
Kanan was in the field. And
he was in the field, right?
Although I was not attending for personal and professional reasons, we had KBU reporters and had colleagues in the field coast to coast. So I was fielding their experiences remotely.
We got many different perspectives of that. And so this last Saturday, the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform hosted a march and rally that marched from the MLK statue to Maranatha Church. Was that maybe like a mile away? And it was attended by, they estimated, between 2,000 to 3,000 people. So it was quite large. So yeah, go them. I attended the march, and I was actually one of the speakers. And Kanan, you attended as well, correct?
Yep.
And so we're here to kind of give our perspectives about the contrast between the two marches, as well as their similarities.
I wish everybody could see Jen's smirk right now. It is the one thing that I'm always wishing that we could change with radio, like somehow like a hologram.
You know, to be honest, too often I wonder if people can actually see that sometimes.
I think they're aware they can hear. Those who are listening, if you can hear Jen smirk, I think that means you're at least 25% woke. I'm just going to say that right now.
So let's just get right into it. So Kanan, as someone who attended the march, and you were there and you watched all the speakers and stuff, what were your impressions of that march in comparison to Saturday's or to the march 2 weeks before that at the Women's March?
So they're both permitted.